contact with the diseased, and yet did not die, as if the pestilence struggled against their purpose. The bodies of the dead were at first buried in Constantinople's tombs. When those were filled, mass graves were dug all over the city. Ceremony was non-existent. The bodies were slung into the graves as fast as possible. When Justinian, who himself suffered from buboes, according to Procopius, but recovered, realized that there was nowhere left to dig new graves, he ordered the tops of the towers just across the Golden Horn ripped off, and the towers themselves filled with bodies. An evil stench pervaded the city, Procopius writes, and distressed the inhabitants still more. Plague brought a temporary end to the war with Persia. The sickness appeared in Ctesiphon, and Khosrau himself abandoned the battlefield, retreated back across the Euphrates, and went home to take care of his people. By the following year, plague had spread westward, as far as the lands of the Franks. Gregory of Tours records outbreaks of swellings in the groin in Arles in 543. But the deadliness of the plague was also its weakness. By 543, it had killed so many people, as many as 200,000 in Constantinople alone, that it could no longer remain at full strength. It had run out of uninfected hosts and began to decrease. Which meant that Khosrau was able to return. In 544, he made a great push against the Byzantine fortress of Edessa. If Edessa fell, Khosrau could sweep across the Byzantine land all the way into Asia Minor, claiming it for his own. It was a well-defended fortress, and he planned the siege carefully. His men took their time, building a huge circular mound outside the city walls, painstakingly constructing it, layer by layer, from earth and timber. Elevating it gradually and pushing it forward towards the town, Evagrius writes, he raised it to a height sufficient to overtop the wall, so that the besiegers could hurl their missiles from vantage ground against the defenders. The city's defenders, desperate to bring the mound down, tunneled underneath the city walls, dug a chamber under the mound, and tried to set a fire beneath it, but there wasn't enough air in the underground chamber to feed the flames. Eventually, using a combination of sulfur and bitumen, they convinced the wood to burn. Smoke started to come up through the pile. To keep the Persians from discovering the fire underneath, the soldiers on the walls of the city shot burning arrows into the top of the mound, using the smoke of the smaller fires to conceal the larger one. Finally, the pile of timber and earth went up in flames, and the mound came down. Khosrau sent his armies against the walls in a last attack, but the entire population of the city, women and children included, formed chains up to the walls, passing heated oil for those at the top to pour over the stones onto the attackers. The Persian soldiers began to retreat, and Khosrau could not keep them moving forward. When an interpreter came out on the walls to offer a treaty, he accepted. The city paid him an enormous ransom in gold. He retreated, and not long afterwards concluded a 5-year treaty with Justinian that brought temporary peace to both of the war-ravaged, plague-decimated empires. Both Procopius and Evagrius attribute the lifting of the siege of Edessa to a sacred object, a relic that had been kept in Edessa for centuries. According to the people of the city, a king named Abgar had ruled Edessa in AD 30. He had fallen ill and had sent messengers to Jerusalem to ask the prophet Jesus to heal him. Jesus had written back, promising healing by means of the letter and the disciple who carried it. When the letter arrived in Edessa, Abgar was made well. Eusebius, bishop of Caesarea, claimed in the early 4th century not only to have seen the letter, but to have translated it from the original Syriac. Before long, the story had expanded. The disciple was said to have brought not only the letter, but also a miraculous cloth with the face of Jesus divinely imprinted on it. It was this cloth, known as the Mandilion, that the people of Edessa treasured. They believed, says Procopius, that the city could never be conquered as long as the Mandilion was inside it. Evagrius insists that the fire under the mound caught only after the Mandilion was washed in water, and the water was sprinkled on the timber. The fire burned so hot that Khosrau was forced to recognize his disgraceful folly in having entertained an idea of prevailing over the God whom we worship. Set beside the accounts of the plague, the story shows a world in which Christianity coexisted uneasily with the sheer power of natural forces. For this calamity there is no explanation, except indeed to refer it to God, Procopius writes baldly, and then later adds, I am unable to say whether the cause of diversity in symptoms was to be found in the difference in bodies, or in the fact that it followed the wish of him who brought the disease into the world. Evagrius ascribes the course of the plague to the good pleasure of God, and for John of Ephesus the horror was a sign of grace and a call to repentance. Yet none of the 6th-century historians suggest that Christ, who had lifted the siege at Edessa, might also lift the plague. War was human, plague was something else, something under God's command yet also woven into the fabric of the universe. Chapter 30. The Heavenly Sovereign. Between 536 and 602, the king of Baekje appeals to the Yamato ruler in Japan. Buddhism travels eastward to the Japanese islands, and the Yamato court issues its first constitution. In 536, 9 years after Buddhism came to his country, King Pophong of Silla declared the beginning of a new era, Kon-won, the initiated beginning. He had already made Buddhism the state religion, issued a code of law, and given Silla a bureaucracy. The new name marked the birth of Silla as a state just as important as its neighbours, Baekje and Goguryeo. Now the peninsula was laid out in a three-kingdom opposition of equals, in language, in race, in custom, in shared culture, and now in religion, the kingdoms were the same. Silla's rise to maturity had brought it into line with its companions. All three were Buddhist countries with monarchs, bureaucracies, codes of law, aspirations to be all things Chinese, and ambitions to be the biggest fish in the pond. Unfortunately, there was little room to expand on the peninsula. The sea to the south and east, the Chinese to the west, and the sheer cold to the north meant that the three, like kingdoms, continually pushed back and forth against each other, with power shifting from one side of the peninsula to each other. The Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, and the Franks all had enough space to spread out over a comfortable area without bumping constantly up against each other. But the kingdoms of the peninsula had to fight, and they did so, constantly, without any one kingdom either disappearing or dominating for very long. Around 540, while Silla was flourishing, the neighbouring state of Baekje was also in the midst of a renewal. Pofang of Silla had chosen the idea of time to unify his people, giving them a sense of their place on the vast calendar of Asian peoples. The king of Baekje, King Seong, chose place instead. He moved the capital away from its safe, confined, mountain-protected location at Ungjin and established it instead at Sabi on the Kum River in a broad central plain. The message of the move was simple. Baekje would no longer be a defensive, wall-building, cowering state protecting its own territory, but an expansive country with ambitions to dominate the peninsula. In an effort to establish himself as the premier power among the three kingdoms, King Seong of Baekje made an alliance with the southern Liang of China. Going one better on Goguryeo, which had also allied with the south of China, he made diplomatic contact with the northern dynasties of the eastern and western Wei as well. Goguryeo, still the biggest and most powerful of the three kingdoms, was a bitter enemy of the northern Chinese kingdoms, which were near enough for it to reach threatening fingers into the upper reaches of the peninsula. With water between himself and the mainland, King Seong of Baekje was more willing to make goodwill gestures, particularly those that might put Goguryeo at a disadvantage. In the 540s, Goguryeo began to suffer through assassination and civil war. It remained powerful, but unrest in the capital, Pyongyang, meant, inevitably, that less attention was devoted to protecting its borders. At the same time, King Pofang of Silla died and was succeeded by the young and ambitious King Qinhong, who inherited a well-organized and peaceful country ready to expand. The king of Baekje took advantage of both events. He convinced Qinhong of Silla to join with him in alliance and attack the giant Goguryeo. In particular, Seong of Baekje had his eye on land in the Han River Basin, which had once belonged to Baekje, but had been taken away in the conquests of Gwanggaeto the Great a century before. As far as he was concerned, that land was captive. Goguryeo might claim it, but it was Baekje territory kept prisoner. The distracted armies of Goguryeo were unable to defend the territory, and by 551, the combined armies of Silla and Baekje had driven them out. But Qinhong of Silla had been playing a double game. He He now turned against his ally and took the land for himself. Seong of Baekje hung grimly on to the Lower Han for some time, but his troops were soon driven out. He had picked a fight with the giant and gotten nothing for it, and he was enraged. He went home and made a new plan. He sent presents, a statue of the Buddha made of gold and copper, and books of Buddhist scriptures eastward to the island of Japan, and asked its king for help. Author's note: although Buddhist statues and books may have arrived in Japan before 552, this is the generally accepted date for the introduction of the Buddhist religion to the island. See Robert Reichar, Early Japanese History, Part A, for a brief summary of the debate. For at least two centuries, the kingdoms on the peninsula had known of the inhabitants of the eastern island. Known as the Wa, they appeared occasionally to trade, to buy, and every once in a while to join in a war. We know very little about the earliest days of the Wa. There is no written history from the ancient cultures of Japan. Its oldest historical account, the Kojiki, was not written until the 7th century AD. Archaeologists, working from objects rather than stories, speak of the first era of Japanese history as the Jomon period. Jomon means cord marked, and during the Jomon period, the inhabitants of the Japanese islands marked their clay by pressing braided cords into it. Author's note: the Jomon period runs from around 10,000 to 400 BC. Archaeologists further divide the Jomon period into incipient Jomon, 10,000 to 7,500 BC, initial Jomon, 7,500 to 4,000 BC, early Jomon, 4,000 to 3,000, middle Jomon, 3,000 to 2,000, late Jomon, 2,000 to 1,000, and final Jomon, 1,000 to 400 BC, each period distinguished by developments in pottery style and advances in farming and other cultural attainments. Around 400 BC, a new culture seems to have begun spreading down from the north of the islands, bringing with it new methods of farming, innovations in working bronze and copper, and other advances. These skills were probably brought to Japan by settlers from China, or from the Korean Peninsula, or by a mingling of both. The combination of native culture with these new immigrant skills marks the next historical period, the Yayoi, which ran, after a century or so of transition, from 300 BC to around AD 250. By AD 250, Japan, like its neighbors to the west, was mutating from a land filled with allied warrior clans into a nation with a monarchy. The warrior clans, known as Uji, still existed. The geography of the country, four larger islands and a swarm of smaller ones, mountains chopping even the continuous surface of the larger islands into smaller self-contained areas, lent itself to multiple independent groups ruling themselves. However, by AD 270, Japan had at least one monarch and one royal family. The Yamato dynasty ruled the flat, fertile plain on the largest island, the Yamato Plain, which gave easy passage to the inland sea. The first period of Yamato control was marked by the coronation of the semi-mythical ruler Ōjin in AD 270. Ōjin, the first Japanese monarch in the Kojiki, who can be connected with a real historical personage, was 70 when he ascended to the throne, and he reigned for an improbable 40 years. Author's note: the Yamato dynasty was divided into two parts, the Kofun period, 270 to circa 538, and the Asuka period, 538 to 715. Both names are designations for types of burial mounds used during these times. In fact, the real Ōjin was probably not a king, but a warrior chief who had managed to subdue his neighbors. For the next few centuries, his family would govern at Yamato. But they were not rulers of their entire domain, let alone the nearby islands. They would become known as Tenno, heavenly sovereigns. They did not command world-conquering armies or control trade routes. They provided instead a nexus point where the divine could meet the earthly, where the presence of the sacred provided, in a way unclear to us from the contemporary sources, a stable center for the people of the islands. Author's note: I have followed Joan Piggott in avoiding the use of the terms emperor and imperial for the power of the Japanese sovereign during this period. Piggott writes, "The term empire is strongly associated with a martial political formation founded on conquest. In contrast, The Tenno did not conquer his realm. He had no standing army save some frontier forces, and the realm remained significantly segmented. A mass of tribal chieftains and war leaders spun around the Yamato center. On the island to the south, known as Kyushu, lived clans known as Bambetsu, foreign clans, networks of families whose ancestors had, within living memory, migrated from the Korean peninsula or from the Chinese mainland and settled in a new home. On the northern island, Hokkaido, lived people whom the Yamato called the Izo, the barbarians. It didn't take much of a royal line before a people drew a line between civilization, themselves, and barbarians, the others. The 552 arrival of the gifts from the Baekje presented the Yamato ruler with a decision: to accept and ally, or to reject and isolate. Japanese chronicles tell us that the heavenly sovereign, Kimei, summoned the clan leaders loyal to him and asked them whether or not to accept the gifts. The heavenly sovereign may have been the nexus of divine power on earth, but the clan leaders exercised much of the real political power in the land of the Wa, and in this case, they were divided. The Nakatomi clan, which controlled the worship of the traditional Japanese deities, was opposed, as were the members of the Mononobe clan, who objected not so much to the religion as to its foreignness. On the other hand, the leader of the Soga clan, the most powerful in Japan, argued that since every other kingdom now followed the Buddha, it was high time for Japan to follow suit. He had apparently been convinced by the message Seong sent from distant India to the three kingdoms of Korea. Seong had written craftily, "All receive these teachings, and there is none who does not revere and honor them." No one east of China wanted to live in a backwater, or to get a reputation as the last hick town out of the mainstreams. Kimei decided to keep the statue, and in return dispatched an army to help Seong out. King Seong launched an attack against Kwansan Fortress, the keystone to the defense of the Silla frontier. Despite the reinforcements, the battle was a disaster. Seong was killed, the Baekje army was driven back, and Chin Hung of Silla, elated by his success, kept fighting his way south until he held not only the land around the Han River, but also the land along the Naktong River, all the way to the southern coast of the peninsula. In just a few years, Chin Hung had turned his country into the largest and strongest on the peninsula. The map had shifted again. Silla, not Goguryeo, had risen to the top of the heap, and the new king of Baekje, Seong's son, Widdeok, hastily made an alliance with his previous enemy, the king of Goguryeo, to protect himself against further aggression. Meanwhile, east of the peninsula, the image of the Buddha was in peril. The Yamato monarch Kimei had allowed the Soga chief, Sogalname, to build a temple and begin following the ways of the Buddha, but the religion was definitely on probation. The Nakatomi chief had already warned that the old gods of Japan would punish this foreign trespass on their territory. Soga Iname ignored the warning until an epidemic broke out in the capital city and intensified. He finally heeded the Nakatomi advice, threw the statue into a canal, and burned down the temple. But the teachings of the Buddha had already taken hold. It is difficult for us to know exactly what the traditional faith of Japan, later known as Shinto, looked like before the arrival of Buddhism. Writing came to Japan along with Buddhism, so all of the descriptions we have were written well after Buddhism had worked its way into the Japanese landscape. But in its earliest forms, Shinto depended on rituals conducted at kami, sacred places where earthly existence and the sacred world were thought to intersect. Clan leaders were charged with supervising the rituals and keeping the kami unpolluted. Whatever else it encompassed, in the 6th century Shinto was firmly connected to particular places. It was, in the strictest sense, a local religion. The universalism of Buddhism meant that the two faiths did not collide. Buddhism, with its global truths, its focus on vast, all-encompassing realities, offered answers to questions that Shinto did not ask. The gold and copper Buddha might lie in the mud of a canal bed, but after 552, the Buddha's words spread unstoppably through the islands of Japan. By getting rid of the Buddha, Sogalname had protected his clan's power. Now the dissident Nakatomi couldn't use the new religion as justification to challenge the Soga hold over the emperor. The monarch Kimei and his dynasty called themselves great kings, but their greatness was a tentative and wary affair. They channeled divinity in their role as heavenly sovereign, but their earthly power was supported by growing reliance on Soga strength. Of Kimei's three royal wives, two were of Soga family. Kimei himself arranged the marriage of his son and heir, Bidatsu, to one of his own daughters, the prince's half-sister by a Soga wife, tying the clan even more closely to the throne. When he died, the prince Bidatsu came peacefully to the crown. When Bidatsu died after a 13-year reign, he was followed by his half-brother Yome, who reigned for 2 years, and then his half-brother Shushun, 5 years. All were children of Kimei's Soga wives. The Soga had a vested interest in keeping them in power. Shushun, like his brothers, had been brought to the throne and maintained there by Soga influence. Unlike his brothers, he quarreled with the kingmakers. He fell out with the current chief of the Soga clan, Soga no Umako, who was also his uncle. He hated his uncle for the high-handed way in which he ran the government as the great imperial chieftain, the official chronicles tell us. One day the head of a wild boar was presented to him, and the sovereign pointedly asked when the head of his hated enemy would be brought in like manner. Soga no Umako got word of this not-so-veiled threat and acted first. He sent an assassin to get rid of his royal nephew. At the same time, he led his clan in a concerted attack on the most powerful rival to Soga power, the anti-Buddhist clan of the Mononobe, allies of the equally anti-Buddhist Nakatomi family. When the dust had settled, the Mononobe had been badly defeated, although not destroyed, and Shushun was dead. The senior claimant to the throne was a woman named Suiko, triply qualified to rule. She was a daughter of Kimei, and thus half-sibling to the previous rulers. Her mother was from the Soga clan, and she had been not only the monarch Bidatsu's half-sister, but also his wife. Soga no Umako wanted her on the throne. He wanted someone he could control, so chose a woman, the chronicles tell us. Alongside of her, he placed as regent yet another Soga relative, Shotoku Taishi, a Buddhist scholar who became the first true statesman of Japan. 19, at his appointment in 593, the regent Shotoku hit his stride in his 30s. He sent envoys to the Chinese kingdom, demanding that the ambassadors be received as representatives of an equal and sovereign nation. In an attempt to diminish the power of the clan leaders, he instituted a Chinese-style set of government ranks, naming each rank after a cardinal virtue, such as fidelity, justice, and wisdom, in order to remind the officials that they were serving because of their character, not their birth. And he took it upon himself to create a written statement of the principles by which the Yamato dynasty held power. For the first time, the heavenly sovereign would move beyond the vague claim of divine sanction as he grasped his power. The 17-article constitution, the Jushichijo no Kenpo, was issued in 602. It is not exactly a constitution in the Western sense. It does not lay out a structure for government or restrict the power of the ruler. Instead, it lists the principles by which the Yamato monarchs should be ruling their country, and by which the people should agree to be ruled. If the governing harmonize, and the governed are hospitable, and matter accords argument, reason will find its way. Upon the imperial command, scrupulous obedience should be practiced. The Lord is the heaven, the subject is the earth. Therefore the Lord speaks, the subjects obey. Disobedience leads to self-defeat. If the people observe decorum, the state will govern itself. The Constitution reveals in every line the conviction that the monarch is the government, that the king is the law. If the king is law, there is no need for a written law to restrict him. There is simply the need, ongoing and prior to all else, that the ruler be moral and virtuous. The Constitution does not try to lay down law. It tries to define the moral character of the king, and also his people. All else should flow harmoniously from this. It was an elegant and simple point of view. If the occupant of the royal palace was morally and spiritually pure, the country would be at peace. At its core, it was a political philosophy that denied Soga power. If the monarch was not only heavenly sovereign, but also the embodiment of earthly law, there was no place in Japan for Soga maneuvering. By appointing Shotoku as regent, the Soga patriarch had inadvertently kicked away the underpinnings of his own power. Yet, like the mandate of heaven, the 17-article constitution also had a sting in its tail for the king. Loss of virtue meant that the spiritual power of law no longer inhered, that a heavenly sovereign, who was not a righteous ruler, was merely masquerading as rightful king. Loss of virtue meant that the ruler could be removed, in full compliance with the constitution itself. Chapter 31. Reunification. Between 546 and 612, the Sui dynasty brings the north and south back together, and the Tang dynasty reaps the benefits. Across the ocean, Liang Wudi of the southern Liang tried again to enter a monastery and devote himself to enlightenment. He had been king of the southern Liang for 45 years. He was old, he was tired, and the wars in the outside world brought him no closer to peace. Again, his ministers paid a ransom to get him out, this one even larger. Again, Liang Wudi was forced to leave the monastery and go back to his palace. Not long after his return to the throne, there was another turnover in power to the north. The general behind the Eastern Wei throne, Gao Huan, died. He had kept alive the fiction that a legitimate Wei ruler still sat on the throne by ruling from the shadows through a puppet emperor with royal blood. It was a traditional strategy, one that preserved the myth of the heaven-selected emperor, but Gao Huan's second son had no patience with it. In 550, he deposed the puppet emperor and announced that he was emperor, founder of a new dynasty, the Northern Qi. 2 years after he took the throne, he had the former puppet emperor and his entire family murdered. Now, the three dynasties that ruled in China were the Southern Liang, the Western Wei, and the Northern Qi. Of the three, the Western Wei and the Northern Qi were of northern blood, and the Southern Liang continued to view them as foreign. The old hostility between Chinese and barbarian was far from dead. Southerners scorned northerners, while northerners were touchy and defensive about their barbarian past. The northerner, Yang Zhuangzi, wrote, in the 6th century, of a drunken southerner who says loudly to his friends, in the hearing of the palace master of the north, that the northerners are nothing but barbarians. The legitimate imperial succession is in the south, he sneers. The northern palace master retorts that he wouldn't live in the south for the world. It is hot and humid, crawling with insects and infected with malaria, he snaps. You may have a ruler and a court, but the ruler is overbearing and his subordinates violent. Our Wei dynasty has received the imperial regalia and set up its court in the region of Mount Song and Luoyang. It controls the area of the five sacred mountains and makes its home in the area within the four seas. Our laws on reforming customs are comparable to those of the five ancient sage rulers. Ritual music and laws flourish to an extent not even matched by the 100 kings. You, gentlemen, companions of fish and turtles, how can you be so disrespectful when you come to pay homage at our court, drink water from our ponds, and eat our rice and millet? This northern defense appealed to ritual, law, custom, learning, and divine sanction, every ancient tradition, bar bloodlines, that the south claimed as its own. When the Northern Qi dynasty replaced its predecessor, though, one northerner decided to put away that hostility long enough to ally himself with the south. The general Hu Jing, who had served the Western Wei, decided that he had no future in the new regime. He sent a message to Liang Wudi, offering to hand over to the south 13 former Wei territories and a sizable army in return for a high southern government post. Liang Wudi accepted the offer, but when the promised promotion came through, Hao Jing found his new rank insufficient. He allied himself with another malcontent of Liang Wudi's many sons, Jian, also unhappy with his preferment. Together, the two men assembled an army and marched to the southern Liang capital, Nanjing, Jianqing, where the old king was forced to defend himself against a long and brutal siege. Contemporary chronicles tell of the starving population chasing rats through the streets in hopes of getting a mouthful of meat, of soldiers boiling their own leather armor, trying to make it soft enough to eat. Finally, Liang Wudi surrendered to the inevitable. He opened the gates and let his son and former ally through. Jian deposed his father, sparing his life, but he imprisoned Liang Wudi and allotted him so small a daily allowance of food and water that the old man weakened and died. He was 86 years old, and since claiming the crown by force, he had tried to relinquish it on 3 separate occasions. Jian, now Liang Jian Wendi, lasted barely a year before his co-conspirator, Hao Jing, murdered him. The general then fell in turn, when the dead king's younger brother raised a rebellion against Hao Jing and cornered him in the palace. The memory of the horrible siege was still fresh, and the people of Nanjing enthusiastically ripped Hao Jing to pieces. The younger brother then took the throne himself as Liang Yuandi, third king of the southern Liang. Liang Yuandi was a scholarly man, a Taoist, unlike his father, with over 200,000 books in his personal library. His reign was less than 3 years long. One of his own nephews went north, gathered a northern army, and then came back south and threatened to besiege Nanjing again. Seeing that defeat was inevitable, Liang Yuandi turned on his books and burned them. Buddhism had not straightened his father's path, Taoism had not delivered him. The instability of the southern Liang throne continued, with three emperors claiming the crown between 554 and 557. In 557, the short-lived dynasty ended when an army general named himself founder of the new southern Chen dynasty. This one would last barely 30 years. The north was in no better shape. The western Wei also fell when another army officer pursued the same path. He deposed the king and named not himself, but his son, king of the new northern Zhao. A few decades earlier, the eastern Wei, western Wei, and southern Liang had governed. Now the three kingdoms in China were the northern Qi, the northern Zhao, and the southern Chen. In 577, the northern Zhao absorbed the northern Qi, and China was once again divided into two, the northern Zhao and the southern Chen, occupying almost the same territory as the old Bei Wei and southern Liang kingdoms 40 years before. Assassination and usurpation had begun to snowball into custom. Legitimacy was clearly a myth on both sides of the Yangtze. For a time it had become clear that divine sanction went to the man with the biggest sword. The North and South had now drawn themselves together into two separate kingdoms. The fracturing spin-off of separate realms had slowly reversed itself. But the Yangtze, wide and slow, lay between the ancient, self-proud South and the ambitious newcomers to the North. A southerner named Yan Zhitui, serving at the southern Liang court, was forced to flee north when the southern Chen deposed his employers. In his northern exile, cut off from his roots, he wrote down a set of rules for his sons to follow so that they could adjust to this new culture without violating his southern principles. Whereas southerners maintain a dignified silence over family affairs due to respect for each other, he warned, northerners not only discuss these things loudly in public, but even ask each other questions about it. Do not inflict such matters on others. If someone else asks you such questions, give evasive answers. Northerners resent criticism, he points out, while southerners prefer to be criticized so that they can learn their failings and make improvements. Southern women conduct themselves in privacy, but his sons should be cautious of women in the north who take charge of family affairs, entering into lawsuits, straightening out disagreements. The streets are filled with their carriages, the government offices are filled with their fancy silks. Those in the north often let their wives manage the family. This, he adds, with the disdain of the Chinese courtiers for the barbarian, may be the remnant of the customs of the Tuoba. Despite any lingering barbarian practices, Zhao Wu of the northern Zhao had ambitions to reunite the whole country under his throne, something that had not been done since the collapse of the Jin dynasty more than two centuries before. He was young, ambitious, sane. But just as he began to plan the conquest, he grew ill. He was on campaign when the sickness killed him at the age of 35. The honor of reuniting China would fall to one of his officials, Yang Jun, a man of his own age who had fought for him, had given his daughter to be the crown prince's wife, and had been rewarded with the noble title Duke of Sui. Yang Jian, loyal to his emperor's family, helped the dead king's son, his own son-in-law, Zhao Xuan, ascend the throne of the north in 578. Zhao Xuan was already 19. His father had sired an heir in his early years. Unlike his father, he did not have his eye on long-lasting glory. Instead, he proved to be more interested in his immediate power. He began to call himself the Heaven, designating his courtiers as the Earth. He forced all of his officials to get rid of any ornaments or decorative clothing so that his own costume would stand out. He began to execute anyone who offended him. He went on lavish royal progresses through the countryside to demonstrate his power, leaving his father-in-law, Yang Jian, in charge at home. A year after his coronation, he made his own 6-year-old son emperor in name, apparently to give himself more freedom to indulge in his pleasures, which included beating and raping the women of the court. All this time, young Zhan managed to keep the government running smoothly, which Xiao Xuan both relied on and resented. As young Zhan's position and reputation rose ever higher, the contemporary Sui history records, the emperor more and more regarded him with dislike. He threatened to execute his wife, young Zhan's daughter, and began to plan the assassination of young Zhan himself. Fortunately for the northern Chinese, the wayward emperor had a stroke and died in 579 at the age of 20. Young Zhan, seeing his old friend's kingdom in danger of falling apart, took immediate steps. He forged a document making him regent for the new emperor, his 7-year-old grandson Zhao Jing, and began to form an inner circle that could help him establish himself as the new ruler of the north. Among his familiars were a competent general named Gao Ying and a great writer named Li Delin. Gao Ying helped him wipe out opposition to his regency, while Li Delin wrote beautifully convincing political rhetoric about young Jian's right to rule. In September of 580, the child emperor signed an edict giving official praise to young Jian's worthiness. It acknowledged him as supreme pillar of state, grand state minister, responsive to the mountains and rivers, answering to the emanations of the stars and planets. His moral force elevates both the refined and the vulgar. His virtue brings together what is hidden and what is manifest, and harmonizes heaven and earth. Like so many soldiers before him, young Zhan was in search of more than just power. Over the last decades, mere conquest had produced short-lived, unstable kingdoms. He was after a lasting empire, and that meant he needed the mandate of heaven. The edicts continued. In October, young Zhan gave his grandfather, father, and great-grandfather posthumous royal titles. In December, he made himself a prince, a higher rank than any other noble at court. In January of 581, an edict of abdication appeared, more of Li Delin's words, again with young Zhao Jing's signature at the bottom. Young Jian made the customary demur, refusing 3 times to take the title, but was eventually persuaded to ascend to the throne as Sui Wendi, Emperor of the North. He declared his rule the beginning of a new dynasty, the Sui, rightful rulers of the North. He then made sure that the mandate of heaven would be unchallenged by murdering 59 members of the northern Zhao ruling family. Among them was his grandson, who died in July at the will of the Sui. In 582, the king of the southern Chen died and was succeeded by a dissolute and extravagant son, and the new Sui emperor saw his chance to begin the reunification. He spent a careful 7 years preparing the ground for invasion. The attack was prefaced with rhetoric. The emperor Sui Wendi, the one-time general Yang Jian, sent agents into the south with 300,000 copies of a manifesto listing all of the faults of the new southern emperor, and explaining that vice had deprived the southern dynasty of the mandate of heaven. In 589, the actual war began. Sui Wendi marched towards the southern capital Nanjing. By the time his armies arrived at the city's walls, the power of the southern Chen had crumbled. With remarkable ease, the Sui forces took control of the city and then of the south. Sui Wendi had restored China to unity with his 2-pronged strategy. First words, then swords. Next, he put into place a whole series of quick and effective reforms. He deprived everyone but the army of weapons, thus reducing the possibility of rebellion and eliminating bloody private feuds. He ordered the Great Wall, the barrier against northern invasion, to be rebuilt where it had crumbled. He reorganized the 2 untidy governments of the north and south into a single rational, efficient unit, highly structured and hierarchical, each office having its own rank, its own set of privileges, and even its own particular uniform. Like Justinian to his west, he ordered that a new set of laws be drawn up that would apply across the entire empire, replacing the untidy, contradictory mass of local regulations, the New Code. To reduce southern hostility to the northern takeover, he married his son and heir, Yang Di, to a southern bride. And recognizing that the north and south would never hold together without free intercourse between them, he began to build a series of new canals from waterway to waterway that would ultimately link the Yellow and Yangtze rivers. The finished waterway became known collectively as the Grand Canal. Recognizing that a country gained cohesion in the face of an outside enemy, he began a war with the Korean kingdom of Goguryeo, close enough to be considered a threat, Weak enough, Sylla still dominated the peninsula to pose no serious or immediate threat to his power. This would prove to be a disastrous mistake, one that would bring the Sui down in its infancy, but the scope of the error would not be seen for another decade. In 604, the Emperor Sui Wendi died, ruler of a united China. He had single-handedly established China as a newly strong country. New law, new defenses, new canal, new war. Sui Wendi was Sui China, acting out his own virtues and vices in its landscape. Those virtues and vices continued to work themselves out under his son, and the vices proved stronger. For one thing, no matter how great the Grand Canal, and it was indeed a dazzling network of rivers and man-dug channels that ran for over 1,000 miles from north to south, with roads and post stations and royal pavilions all along its banks, it had been built with an enormous outlay in manpower. Over 5 million Chinese were forced to labor on the canal for part of the year, many dying of the hard labor, many more impoverished by the months spent away from their own crops and herds. Tax money had been poured into the water like sand. And for the last years of his reign, Sui Wendi had been stymied by his war with Goguryeo. The country was proving unexpectedly hard to conquer, thanks to the stiff resistance of the great Goguryeon general Eulji Mundiok. Wendi's son Sui Yangdi inherited his crown and his problems, which he immediately worsened. Rather than retrenching, Sui Yangdi carried on his father's attempt to build a country in less than one generation. He stepped up on the taxes and labor in order to complete the Grand Canal, and took a victory sail on the completed waterway, with 65 miles of royal vessels following stem to stern behind him, celebrating the accomplishment while ignoring the human cost. He grew obsessed with completing the conquest of Goguryeo, pouring the remaining treasury into it and sending troops into the Korean peninsula over the bodies of their fallen comrades. The war had now dragged on for nearly 20 years. The standing Sui army of 300,000 soldiers had been reduced to less than 3,000. Sui Yangdi drafted, conscripted, and enslaved enough men for one final push. In 612, he took an army, reported to be more than 1 million men strong, into tiny Goguryeo, where Eulji Mundiok made his stand at the capital city Pyongyang. In a fierce, epically bloody battle, the Korean soldiers surrounded and obliterated the Chinese troops. The embarrassing and horrendous defeat spelled the end for Sui Yangdi. A rebel officer declared himself to be emperor, and Sui Yangdi lost Luoyang to the revolt in 618. He died in the battle for the city, and the rebel officer ascended the throne as the emperor Gaozu, founder of a new dynasty, the Tang. Tang Gaozu inherited a troubled country. The final years of the Sui had reduced both north and south to unhappy poverty. The king of Goguryeo was on the attack, and the treasury was empty. But he also inherited a country which, despite the fatal flaws of the Sui regime, many of the essential difficulties had been solved. He inherited a strong administrative structure, a law code, a north-south trade route, a fortified capital city, a system of governing the far-flung edges, a tax structure. The Tang would rule over China for centuries, but they owed their existence to the bloody and short-lived innovations of the Sui. Chapter 32. The South Indian Kings. Between 543 and 620, the Chalukya kingdom spreads, a polymathic Pallava ruler fights back, and Harsha of the north almost captures the south. In 543, the jagged landscape of small kingdoms in the south of India began to smooth itself into an empire. The king who took the first step towards conquest was Pulakesi, ruler of the Chalukya. The Chalukya tribe lived in the Deccan. They had probably come down from the north at some distant period, but now were thoroughly native to central India. For centuries, they had existed more or less in peace, but in the 6th century, Pulakesi, charismatic and ambitious, began to create a small empire out of a tribal kingdom. Pulakesi's capital city was Vatapi, and his conquests pushed the Chalukya empire out from that center against the neighboring tribes. He annexed the kingdom of the Vakataka, which had briefly swelled to power during the last days of the Gupta Empire, and now crumbled underneath his approach. He conquered land on the western coast, which meant that the Chalukya could now trade unhindered with the Arabs, but he did not rest his whole claim to authority on his sword. Instead, he boasted of having 59 royal ancestors, giving his dynasty an unlikely sheen of antiquity. Bolstering his authority further, he performed the horse sacrifice, the ancient Hindu ritual that was intended to bring health and strength to the people by channeling it through the king. The horse sacrifice was, in the words of Indologist Hermann Oldenburg, the highest sacral expression of royal might and splendor. It was an elaborate and time-consuming ritual. The consecrated horse was set to wander free for a full year, under guard, before it was brought back to the king. Priests covered the horse with a golden cloth, and the king killed it with his own right hand at the culmination of a 3-day festival. The queen then lay down beside the dead horse, underneath the golden cloth, and acted out sexual congress with the corpse. The strength of the horse and the strength of the king became one. The power of the horse entered the queen and gave birth to a royal heir, who would also bear the divine strength. Power and sex were interrelated. The crown and the passing of the crown to a blood heir were intertwined. It was the sacrifice of an emperor, not a minor king. Pulakesi's sons built on this assertion, putting their swords behind their insistence that they had the right to rule. When the king died in 566, his son, Kirtivarman, took his crown and spent the next 30 years expanding the range of Chalukya power still further. Inscriptions tell us that, among other conquests, he defeated the nearby Mauryans, descendants of the ancient royal house that had once ruled much of India. He also built up the village of Vatapi, filling it with new temples and public buildings, beginning to turn it into a capital city. In 597, Kirtivarman too died, and was succeeded by his young son Pulakesi II. But Pulakesi II did not at once govern his own people. For 13 years, Kirtivarman's brother Mangalesa served as regent, controlling the kingdom even after Pulakesi II was of age. He was reluctant to let go of the king's sword, and as regent, he carried on the conquests of his father and brother. Chalukya momentum was rolling across the center of the subcontinent, but the kingdom's advance would soon be complicated by another rising power, the Pallava, on the eastern coast. In ancient times, the Pallava had lived in Vatapi, the capital city that was now at the center of the Chalukya domain. 200 years earlier, the Chalukya had driven them out, and they had been forced to settle in the territory known as Vengi. The long-ago defeat had produced a deep-rooted hatred between the two peoples. The Chalukya, taking the high ground, accused the Pallava of being hostile by nature, while the Pallava resented Chalukya expansion. Around 600, the Pallava king, Mahendra Varman, came to power. He too would prove to be a charismatic ruler, who lit the fuse of a country's expansion. For the moment, though, he avoided direct conflict with the Chalukya, instead conquering his way through the territory north of the Godavari River. Mahendra Varman stands out in the sketchy chronicles of the South Indian kings, not because of his military victories — every South Indian king boasted of military victories — but because he managed to keep an interest in the arts alive, even while directing the inevitable campaigns against bordering states. He gave himself the name Vichitrachita, which means something like the man with newfangled ideas. He was interested in architecture, pioneering a new method of carving out rock temples. Painting, he commissioned a scholar at his court to write an instructional manual for painters, the Dakshinachitra. Town design, he built a number of new towns incorporating his own engineering techniques. Music, he is credited with inventing a method of musical notation. And writing, he wrote 2 plays in Sanskrit, one of them a satire skewering his own government. Had Mahendravarman lived in the West, with courtiers and monks who were determined to chronicle the exact place he occupied in God's plan for the world, he would stand out in history as a polymathic king, a genius who happened to be born to the crown. Instead, we know of his accomplishments only from single lines of inscriptions. Meanwhile, the Chalukya began to suffer through civil war. The king's ambitious uncle, Mangalesa, had refused to relinquish the throne. He was still ruling as regent, but had hopes of installing his own son as king. He had led the Chalukya to victory over one of their strongest enemies, the Kalachuri. Like Kirtivarman, he had added buildings and cave temples to the capital city of Vatapi. He had every quality of a king, including royal blood, except that he was not in the direct line of succession. In 610, young Pulakesi II rebelled against his uncle's control. An inscription left by Pulakesi II's court poet, Ravikirti, preserves his rationale. Pulakesi II, says the verse, claimed rule as the grandson, namesake, and rightful heir of Pulakesi I, the first of his family to rule the Chalukya as emperor. His grandfather had performed horse sacrifice, and he alone had the right to rule. Details of the rebellion are sketchy. All we know is that Pulakesi II was able to win the support of enough soldiers to assemble an army. Mangalesa's able leadership and royal blood apparently were not enough. The tradition of direct succession trumped his strength. He was killed in the fighting, and Pulakesi II claimed the throne. At once he picked up the sword. The list of chiefs he defeated and forced into obedience is long. Gangas, Latas, Malavas, Gurjaras, and many more. Chalukya power extended across much of the Deccan, and the Pallava and Chalukya armies began to clash. Both of their kings, Pulakesi II of the Chalukya, Mahendravarman of the Pallava, were ambitious men, bounded by sea on either side, setting the stage for an ongoing struggle that would characterize Indian history for decades. However, a bigger threat than either of them had suddenly ballooned to the north. After the rule of the Guptas and Hephthalites, the northern part of India had fallen apart into competing tiny kingdoms and states. But around the beginning of the 7th century, an extraordinary boy named Harshavardhana inherited from his dying father the rule of the small city of Thanesar in the north. Again, the charisma and determination of a single man would change the landscape of a country. Unlike Mahendravarman, Harsha had a courtier who wrote, "This man, Bana, left for us a eulogy praising the king's accomplishments, the Harsha Karita. The Karita describes Harsha's royal ancestry, a line of kings," Bana writes, "dominating the world by their splendor, thronging the regions with their armies in array. In fact, Harsha's family was not particularly distinguished and had never ruled over much in the way of territory, but Harsha's later conquests demanded that he be destined for glory." Harsha had no sooner been crowned king than a message came to him carried by a frantic servant. His sister Rajasri, who had been married to a neighboring king for treaty-making purposes, had been made a widow by her husband's sudden death. Her adopted kingdom was about to be invaded by enemies, and she herself was facing death by fire on a funeral pyre honoring her husband. Harsha assembled an invasion force and went in to rescue her. Bana says that he lifted her from the pyramid of wood just before it could be lit. He then claimed the country for himself. It was the first of many victories. The chiefs he defeated swore loyalty to him one after another, all across North India. As the realm grew, Harsha moved his capital city eastward to Kannauj, closer to the center of his mushrooming realm, and from there he ruled, with his sister as his co-ruler and empress. While she governed, he fought. He united Thanesar and Kannauj and defeated the neighboring tribes in an ever-widening circle around him. In 620, he turned south and met the Chalukya king Pulakesi II at the Narmada River. To have any hope of holding on to his kingdom, Pulakesi II needed to keep Harsha from crossing the river. But his forces were outnumbered. The Chinese monk, Xuanzang, who spent 17 years traveling through India during Harsha's reign, estimated that he had 100,000 horsemen, as many foot soldiers, and 60,000 elephants. Pulakesi's court poet later wrote that the smaller army prepared for battle by getting both themselves and their war elephants drunk. This made them reckless, dangerous, and overwhelming. The strategy is confirmed by Xuanzang. "They intoxicate themselves with wine," he writes, "and then one man with lance in hand will meet 10,000 and challenge them. Moreover, they inebriate many hundred heads of elephants, and taking them out to fight, they themselves first drink their wine, and then, rushing forward in mass, they trample everything down, so that no enemy can stand before them." Drunken courage may have played a part in the battle that followed, but Pulakesi II had the easier task. To enter Chalukya territory, Harsha's army had to fight its way through mountain passes that were much simpler to defend than to seize. The mountains, the river, and the desert at the center of India had long militated against any king managing to sweep both North and South India into the same kingdom. The Chalukya troops were successful, pushing back Harsha's vast invasion force. From that point on, the Narmada was the southern border of his kingdom. This was terribly embarrassing for Harsha. Pulakesi II, great in his own sphere, was a minor ruler compared to Harsha, his kingdom a mere blot against Harsha's vast expanse. But he had staked out his territory and held on to it. He returned from the battle against Harsha, high with victory, and also defeated the Pallava king Mahendravarman and took away the northern provinces. Vengi, the land where the Pallava had settled after being ejected from Vatapi so many years earlier. For the second time, the Chalukya had driven the Pallava from their homeland. Chapter 33. Two Emperors. Between 551 and 579, the Lombards seize Italy, the Persians push into Arabia, and both Justinian and Khosrau leave their kingdoms to lesser heirs. In Constantinople, the plague had finally died away. A five-year truce with the Persians protected the eastern border. At last, Justinian could turn his attention back to his project of conquering the West. The Byzantine army in Italy was stretched to its limits and would not be able to hold out much longer, so Justinian sent the soldier eunuch Narses. Belisarius had recently retired from active duty to Italy, with instructions to hire mercenaries from the Gepids and the Lombards. Both of these tribes had already agreed to settle along the northern edge of the country, but the Lombards proved easier to recruit for actual fighting. The Lombards had probably come, long ago, from the cold northern lands on the far side of the Baltic Sea, known to ancient historians as Scandia. Their own oral history, set down by Paul the Deacon in the 8th century, hundreds of years later, testifies to this origin. The peoples of Scandinavia had grown so great a multitude that they could not now dwell together, Paul writes, so they divided their whole troop into three parts, as is said, and determined by lot which part of them had to forsake their country and seek new abodes. The Lombards, one of those three bands, had been forced by chance to set out for a new home. When Narses arrived in Italy around 551, he promised the Lombards new land in Pannonia in exchange for their help. With the Lombard reinforcements behind him, he picked up the war against the Ostrogoth resistance. Their king Totila had recaptured Rome and mounted his defence there, rather than at Ravenna, but Narses's mercenaries numbered almost 30,000 men. He had recruited not only Lombards, but also a few Gepids and opportunistic Huns. When Narses attacked Rome, 6,000 Ostrogoths died in battle, and Totila was killed. The Goth nobles elected another king, but he too fell in battle. Narses and his mercenaries recaptured Ravenna and re-established a Byzantine capital there. The Ostrogoth domination had ended. Now Italy would be ruled, on behalf of the Emperor Justinian, by a Byzantine official called an exarch, a general who also had authority to administer civilian affairs. Constantinople had regained the heart of the empire, but only after years of war that had destroyed the countryside, wrecked the cities, and impoverished the people. In 552, Justinian also regained control of southern Hispania. The Visigothic king had been murdered, and the court was in disarray. One of the nobles, Athanagild, sent a message to Constantinople, applying unwisely for help in seizing the throne. Byzantine ships arrived to support him, and Athanagild got his throne. But by 554, Byzantine armies had captured ports and fortresses all along the southern coast, and Justinian was able to establish a Byzantine province there with Cartagena as its capital. In the wake of the plague, Justinian was finding victory. He was on the edge of rebuilding the old Roman Empire, restoring the old glories. Byzantine administration now reached to the western edge of the Mediterranean. Rome was once again his. But at once, new challenges arose in the east. Yet again, a new nation had formed itself out of a loose and disorganized tribal confederation. Over the previous century, nomads from northern China, known to the Chinese as the Tu Chui, had made their way westward into Central Asia. One of their war chiefs was named Bumin Khan, and in 552 he gathered his tribe and their allies together at a place called Ergenekon, in the Altai Mountains, and declared himself their king. This declaration must have followed some years of conquest, although those are invisible to us. He also married a Chinese princess from the former Western Wei royal family, adding the sheen of royalty to his rough grasp of power, and established his capital at the city of Otukan. The new state formed by Bumin Khan became known as the Göktürk Khaganate, the first Turkish kingdom. Turkish legends gathered around the mountain stronghold where Bumin Khan created a people. Ergenekon, the ancestral homeland of the Turks, also became a paradise of sorts, a Garden of Eden within living memory. Not long after the gathering at Ergenekon, Bumin Khan died, and his son Mukan took over the brand new country. Mukan began to fight the neighbouring tribes to expand the Göktürk state, driving the nearest tribes, the nomadic Avars, westward towards Persia and Byzantium. In 558, the displaced Avars reached the Byzantine borders, forcing Justinian to buy them off. They kept on going west and finally settled near the Danube, just east of the Gepids. They were not the only peoples disturbed by the new Turkish nation. Mukan managed to conquer the eastern tribes of the Bulgars, agitating the remaining tribes who lived on the western shores of the Don River. Some of them crossed into Byzantine land, but rather than paying them off as well, Justinian recalled Belisarius from his retirement and sent his most experienced general to drive them away. He succeeded, which aroused all of Justinian's old suspicions of his lifelong colleague. Even after decades of reign, Justinian must have felt his throne to be insecure. In 562, he accused Belisarius of corruption and jailed him. The following year, he relented, released his old friend, and pardoned him. It was the last skirmish between the two. Both men died in 565. Justinian was 83, Belisarius 60. When Justinian drew his last breath, so did any chance that the Roman Empire might be revived. Theodora had died childless in 548, probably of cancer, and Justinian had never remarried. He had no sons. His nephew Justin became emperor in his place. Almost at once, the new conquests in the west began to fragment. In Italy, Byzantine domination was threatened by the arrival of plague in the year after Justin II's accession. Paul the Deacon describes the characteristic swellings in the groin, the high fever, the stacks of unburied corpses, Italy emptied and vulnerable. The dwellings were left deserted by their inhabitants, and the dogs only kept house, he wrote. You might see the world brought back to its ancient silence, no voice in the field, no whistling of shepherds, no lying in wait of wild beasts among the cattle, no harm to domestic fowls. The crops, outliving the time of the harvest, awaited the reaper untouched. The vineyard, with its fallen leaves and its shining grapes, remained undisturbed while winter came on. A trumpet as of warriors resounded through the hours of the night and day. Something like the murmur of an army was heard by many. There were no footsteps of